Welcome back to Humans of Speedway's Speedway Paradise. Now, over the course of the winter, my plan is to serialise some of the previous episodes from Humans of Speedway in the Speedway Paradise section, where we get our guests to create their dream Speedway meeting. Now, this works around the same questions. Which track would you choose, regardless of facilities surrounding it, but purely for the racing? Which stadium would that be in? Your all-time 1-7? The best referee, the one rule you would change, and the opposition for your dream team. This has to be a complete team that actually did exist in history. So those are the questions, some fascinating answers through the course of the series, and you can hear them all right now by going to any of the previous episodes. The first one I'm going to pick out for you, though, is from Peter Oakes. Now, Peter Oakes, a long history in Speedway, starting out as a journalist, ending up being Ivan Major's manager, arguably the greatest rider of all time, and so some amazing stories there, and I'm sure that Ivan may well feature in that team. Well, he does. You'll hear that in just a few moments' time. He's also been a promoter, a manager, and is still a journalist to this day, writing articles, and he's got his own column, of course, in the Speedway Star as well. So we're going to speak with Peter Oakes, and here's his Speedway Paradise.
Desert Island Discs, but with a bit more shale.
Yeah. And I like that, Ian. Yeah,
I just came up with that there and then. I don't know why I haven't been saying that for the last 6 weeks.
I see why you're a professional.
Well, I'm just getting away with it for a prolonged amount of time. I think is as we all are. So you're going to host a virtual speedway event then. We're going to start by asking you which track you would choose to race on. This is irrespective of all of the facilities. So we're basing it purely on the shape and the shale. Where are we going to go?
Am I allowed to have two tracks?
Well, why not? Why not?
Well, what I'd have is certainly the old Bellevue, Hyde Road. Best track I've ever seen in Britain. 420 yards, which gives me the facility to have a smaller track inside.
Oh.
And I would go for a Californian track called San Bernardino. I went over to America for a World Team Cup final at Long Beach. And in the week, I went to San Bernardino, which was probably 160, 180 yards, something like that. And I can honestly say I have never, ever seen racing as exciting and close as I did that night at San Bernardino. I don't know whether it was a rarity or whether that was the way it was. So I'd certainly like to put this little San Bernardino track inside the old Hyde Road.
Wow.
And that would be then the absolute two dream circuits for excitement, skill, sheer entertainment. 2:15 heat meetings.
Got you.
And what also are great, you've got the near quarter of a mile of Bellevue, and then you've got this little technical tricky track. You add the points up on aggregate and get the winner at the end of that.
Wow. So you're sorting out the small track men from the big track men in one go?
Yep. It would.
Okay. So which stadium would go around the edge of these tracks then? Because it sounds like a fantastic idea. Based on the facilities, atmosphere, places you've been to in your time, I mean, it may not be standing anymore, but which stadium are we going for?
Has to be Wembley, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, plus the old Wembley, the Twin Towers Wembley. The only drawback about Wembley was the track wasn't very good. So we've already covered that. So we've now got the two perfect tracks and the perfect stadium. I can remember I was fortunate enough to spend a lot of world finals in the pits at Wembley, and to hear the roar of that Wembley crowd when the riders went out on parade was something, you know, you could never, ever forget. I was privileged to be very heavily involved in the 1981 World Final, the last World Final we had at Wembley. And, you know, while the stadium itself was probably just coming towards the end of its life, wasn't it a little worse for wear, but it was such a magical venue. You know, it's why everyone still talks about Wembley today, isn't it? That, you know, when you consider it's nearly 40 years since the last Speedway meeting at Wembley, and everyone still talks about Wembley. Riders who were there still talk about Wembley. riders who weren't there say, I never rode at Wembley, but.
Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic place. You know, the best place in the world.
Now, moving on to the people who are going to take part in this meeting then, riding two meetings in one. Your all-time 1-7. Now, this can be any rider from any era, alive or sadly no longer with us. No points limits involved or anything like that. And obviously, it is just a home meeting, so I suspect Ivan might be involved. But over to you.
I think you're right on that, that Ivan has to be, you know, number one, doesn't he? That his record just proves itself, and that anyone who can win six world titles on a one-off basis, frightening how many he might have won on a Grand Prix basis. And I don't know, we just sort of hit it off that at the time I wasn't married, and that my girlfriend was Pam, and she just hit it off with Ivan's wife, Ray. Because, we became very close friends, and we would go out in an evening together, we'd go off to see a show or things like that. And I can't even remember when we first decided that we'd set up a company between the four of us. We all became four directors of a company called Projector Sport Limited, which handled all Ivan's media appearances, media columns. We started writing columns for, initially, I think the first one was probably the Speedway Star, but as it moved on, I would ghostwrite all his columns. For we'd do it for evening newspapers. We'd arrange for him to appear on radio on quite regularly on the BBC, on the radio, things like Blue Peter, later days, Question of Sport. We just basically hit it off, and I've always said to anyone who's asked, well, how come you got on so well with him? And I firmly believe it is because one reason is that I had absolutely no mechanical knowledge at all. I don't know anything about Speedway engines. I have absolutely no desire to know anything about Speedway engines. It doesn't interest me in the slightest. And I could go along and I would sit in the workshop talking to Ivan while he and his team were working on engines and doing whatever they did. And I think Ivan always felt totally confident that even on the week of the world final, I could sit there and I wouldn't have the slightest clue what he was doing. So I could never, ever give away any mechanical secrets. Ivan would have denied all that and said he never even thought of it. But I still have that little thing at the back of my mind. I think it probably helped that he knew I could never, ever go away and give away any of his workshop secrets.
And I guess you could never question him on what he was doing on that front as well, like, say, versus an ex-rider might.
No, I could never turn around and say, oh, well, why are you putting those handlebars on? Or why are you putting red tape on the throttle twist grip rather than blue tape or white tape? Never, ever could I ask him. All I'd ask him would be, we'd just be talking as you talk with a mate. And, we went on holidays together. And when I moved down to London, after I'd been here, I was only a year in Wales in Cardiff. And then I moved back to London on the paper for the London office. And if Ivan was down in London or off to an airport, he would stay with us. And, we just became, very, very, very close in our, my daughter got on with Ivan's children, and certainly with the two daughters. She was sort of bridesmaid for the eldest daughter, Julie. And, we went on holiday with each other. We go down, I remember one great one when we went to Cornwall, to a place called St. Agnes, which was a beautiful little village on the Cornish coast. And we were on the beach one day, and a little boy came up to Ivan and sort of said, oh, are you Ivan Major? And he probably regretted it afterwards. Ivan turned around and said, no.
Oh, no.
because we treated it was a break you know, we didn't want to be involved in any speedway. We were just out there as a family. And I could always, you know, wonder whether Ivan later on thought, I wish I'd have sort of said yes to that poor little lad. So if he's still around somewhere, an apology on behalf of Ivan.
Yeah, if you ever had that sort of wonder in your mind, then yes, it definitely was him. When you look back at your time with Ivan, and obviously these are rich times, maybe I'm leaping ahead slightly here, what's your sort of favourite story or memory with Ivan that you look back on and maybe smile the most?
Probably the one that I smile the most was a world final at Gothenburg, where Ivan was very much a loner in his preparation for a world final. In the days and the weeks leading up to a world final, he'd become very, very, you know, insular, very much in a zone, get a bit, you know, quite ratty. Like, he would have a go at people. We often sort of said, you know, Ray's life, his wife's life, was hell during the week of a world final. And he also, we would never go into a hotel where the other riders were, because he didn't want to be mixing with them. He wanted to be on his own, do his own thing. And we went to Gothenburg for this world final. And we're out in the, got a hotel in the woods, and we sort of settled in the hotel. And then all of a sudden, through the doors, who should come but Dave Lanning and the entire World of Sport team. So, yeah, and the thought that there we were trying to keep away from everybody, and in comes the man who, you know, Dave, absolutely larger than life. A wonderful personality. Oh, what are you doing here? So, you know, that was one of the funny ones. Another one which I wasn't actually totally privy to what happened, but we were in Denmark, and the intention was that we were going to come back. The meeting was probably either a Saturday or a Sunday, and we were going to come back. But Ivan decided that he wasn't going to come back. He was going to do another meeting over there. All going to come back by car. So he told Ray and Pam, look, we're not coming back. We'll come back later. So this caused, as you can imagine, some fury amongst the two women. So Ray decided, right, I'll show you. So she went and booked on the ferry to go from, what would it have been, Eschberg probably, back, or it might even be in Gothenburg, straight from Gothenburg. Anyway, she booked on the ferry, but it was full. So that gave her a slight problem, but she asked, are you sure it's full? And they said, oh, well, no, the only room that we've had, or the only cabins we have, are the Queen's suite. Right. And that was literally the suite that the Queen used. So okay. Ray said, we'll have it. So Aaron Powell sort of trundled in and had the absolute luxurious, you know, trip back on this ferry. And it was an overnight ferry, it was sort of champagne on Ivan all the time. She said, I'll make him pay for this, you know. So heaven knows what the bill was, but that, you know, it's a side of Ivan that sort of people never saw. And the, like, I did a little thing on, I think, Facebook the other day saying, you know, out of these 10 people, you know, who have I never had a drink with? And you'd be amazed that I would say 50, 60% of the people who answered said Ivan Major. Yeah, which sort of astounded me, because, yeah, Ivan wasn't teetotal. Ivan enjoyed a drink when he wasn't racing. Out of the season, he'd be the first to start drinking. He'd be dancing on tables. But this was a side that not even his rivals ever saw. They didn't know about. And several riders from the time actually said, oh, it'll be Ivan Major that you've never had a drink with. And to give you an idea, that the other people included people like Princess Anne, to name drop.
Yes. Yeah. we can hear them clanging in there.
Yeah, Richard Harris, Roger Moore, who was James Bond, amongst other things. Because my sort of my later career journalistically was showbiz, writing about showbiz and television. So there were all these sort of big names that I'd been out and had lunch with, and there was the one that I'm trying to think. I can't remember who the one I said that who I hadn't been out for a drink. I know sort of Jimi Hendrix was on the list, and yet all these people thought that the one I hadn't ever had a drink with was Ivan, because they thought it was a trick and that Ivan never drank. So you know, it was just nice to know the other side of a person, because yeah, he was, without doubt, he was my best friend. You know, we used to speak when he was over here. We would speak literally every other day. And even when he retired and went back to Australia, we'd still speak at least every couple of weeks, maybe more frequent. So, mm-hmm. You know, it was a friendship that lasted, and the friendship with the family lasts today. We're still in regular touch with each other. You know, we've been Zooming each other, you know, during the pandemic, and it's, you know, it's been such a, you know, we all make special friends, don't we, in our lives, and that was very much a special friend. And you know, we've probably only had maybe one or two fallouts the whole of the time, and it was it was good to be able to also share the some of the success that he had over the years, and to to think I played a part in it. Like financially, our arrangement was always that we split everything. There was never any suggestion of any other way of doing it. That there were four of us who were directors, and we each took 25% of whatever we made out of it all. And
that's really great.
And Ivan was always totally trustworthy with what I did, from the columns I would write for him. But good times.
And Ivan also trusted you with helping him out with the contract details when they came up, sorting out his terms. And I want to delve into the details of an Ivan Major contract, because he had some particular demands that actually got approved by the BSPA. Take note, riders of today. Ivan had a deal with Exeter that he would only ride home meetings.
You know, ourselves and Newcastle, Ian Thomas, had been asked to, the promoters wanted us to go into the first division. We both agreed. We were both told that we would get help with building a team, that they'd ensure that we got access to, to riders. And it just didn't work out that way, that, we couldn't find, because there were now extra teams coming into the top flight, there wasn't an abundance. There was a shortage of riders, and riders just didn't want to go down to Exeter, that Exeter was a very sort of different track. It had this, in many ways, this horrid steel fence. It was banked, it was fast, it was relatively narrow. And riders, very few riders actually lived in the West Country. They nearly all lived in the Midlands or the North. And they wouldn't come down. And I can remember just talking to Ivan one day and saying, would you come and ride us for a season? And he said, no, the only way I'll do it is if I just ride home meetings. So we thought, nothing ventured, nothing gained. We applied to the BSPA, and lo and behold, they agreed to it. So, we actually saw him then in his final season in Britain. That it wasn't a successful season. We had the crowds just didn't respond because of our results. The same, Newcastle had similar problems, and it was another case of where promoters, had made promises which they didn't keep, and as a result, they lost two tracks as a result of it. As far as racing in the first division was concerned, although Exeter did then carry on in the second division, but I don't think neither of us thought he would ride for Exeter. I'd been trying all sorts of people. Originally, I was hoping that he would agree to do a full season home and away, but that wasn't on his agenda. Ivan's contract with Exeter, he insisted on having a private aeroplane pick him up from the airport and fly him down to Exeter. He didn't always stick to that, particularly after the pilot had actually crushed a plane when Ivan wasn't in it. And he started to sort of allow to be picked up by car and taken down to Exeter. He also demanded that got rid of a lot of the green on the Exeter race jackets because he considered green unlucky.
Right.
He never ever demanded to be at number one. Ever. I know some riders would do that. Was in the days, if you remember, you could ride anywhere in the team.
Mm-hmm.
He also had the rights to all the photographs that were image rights, you'd call them today. He was probably the first Speedway rider to have image rights. That was also in his contract. Quite a lot of things. But none of them, you wouldn't look at them and say, oh, they're terribly outrageous, because he produced the goods. Number two, I'd go for Ty Buffenden. I have an involvement with Ty, but I do believe that if anyone is capable of surpassing the six world titles that Ivan and Tony Rickardson have, it has got to be Ty. He's already got three. He's a young man. As long as he retains his hunger, and I think that's the most important thing, if he retains his hunger, he can certainly win six, seven world titles, I think, over time. He's as good as any rider I've ever seen. His mentality is so good. He's a rarity in some ways that he is just so laid back as well. He will stop, he'll talk to you during a meeting. Majority of riders at a world final are a bit insular and keep within themselves, but Ty, I think the typical example of Ty was, wasn't it, when he had that crash in 2017?
Mm-hmm.
Was it 2018? If you remember, in the final round of the GP, he came back into the pits and, totally unfazed and cracking jokes.
Yeah.
I'm saying things like, oh, you have to give him a bit of a show and stuff like that.
And you worked on his on the book as well, didn't you?
Yeah, did the his autobiography with him, which again, super to deal with. If he said he'd be somewhere, if he said to call him at such a time, he was always there, very professional in that way. Never one who would, who you'd ring and then he'd say, oh, yeah, I'm sorry, I forgot, or anything like that. Totally professional in our dealings. Hard worker, workaholic in many ways. Can't sit still, has got to be doing something. Whether that's renovating the house, working in the gardens, or getting ready for his Speedway meetings.
Hard work super pays talent off, doesn't it?
Yes.
So we've got Ivan Major and Ty Woffenden, first two names on the sheet. It's looking good so far. Who's at three?
Well, I have to say that my whole team is world champions.
Wow.
I've not gone for the, the person who, the extrovert who isn't quite as good, because I think if you've got no points limit, you've got to literally go for the riders who score you the most points.
Yeah.
And I don't think any of these need anyone else in them. I'd have to say Barry Briggs. Barry again, never, totally different personality to Ivan. I probably know Briggo better now than I did then, because I suppose being in Ivan's camp, there was always that little bit of maybe an edge that you couldn't really, totally relax. But since retirement, I've got to know Briggo very well. We still speak sort of quite regularly on the phone about different things, not usually Speedway. It's usually about other things that he'll tell me what he's been doing, and do I know where I can find such and such, and how we can speak to the the chief executive of Wembley and stuff like that. He's a super bloke and super character, super rider. Again, he was one of the the big four when they were all handicapped. You couldn't not include him in your top seven. He was such a personality in his own right, and a sporting personality. Even today, if you talk to people of sort of probably my generation and maybe a little bit younger, they all have heard of Barry Briggs, haven't they?
Oh, yeah, everybody's. I mean, and he's done that. He turns up at stadiums. I've seen him going around doing the Benevolent Fund collection with the buckets before.
Have you?
Yeah, at Sheffield, I think it was.
Yeah, but he's not only in Speedway.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Briggo knew all the TV people. He's a, a great personal friend of Bernie Eccleston. He was a great personal friend of Harry Wheatcroft, who owned Donington Park. You know, he's a personal friend of Harry Redknapp.
You know, he's well connected.
He is so well connected, yeah. Totally, and they know him as, you know, Brigone. I've always said to him, I said, well, the greatest asset you had was the alliteration of your name. You know, the Barry Briggs is a name that is easy to remember.
Yes.
But I'm sure it was a bit more than that, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think so.
So that's three riders chosen in your all-time 1-7. Who is going to be at number four then, Peter?
Someone I didn't know that well when he was racing, and got to know him much better in his later days, and certainly since retired, Ovi Funding, who won 5 world finals. He was always appeared to have been a little bit aloof, and, you know, keeping himself to himself, but he isn't, certainly since he's retired, he hasn't been that. He's always very open. I've actually written a piece with him in this week's Speedway Star, when he, you know, contacted me and sort of said, oh, can you do something? I'd like to talk about this. So I obviously rang him back, and we chatted away. And some of the stories he came out with were sort of amazing. You know, he's so open with his own life, his personal life. Amazing person that he, you know, he lives, he's got a house in the south of France near Saint-Tropez. And last Saturday, he actually got on his BMW motorbike and rode all the way to Sweden.
Wow.
And he's 87. He went on his own. He took his tent with him because he wasn't sure he could get accommodation because of lockdown all over, and rode all the way to Sweden.
You're as old as you feel, I guess, is the one saying.
Obviously. And when you talk to people like him and Brigo, you realise what extraordinary people they were. And you also get some inkling as to how they won world championships, because they do have a different outlook on life to people. Like, you know, Brigo is the same. Brigo is still riding his trials bike up in the mountains in Southern California. You know, he goes out regularly, and you get they're more than pensioners, aren't they? They're veteran pioneers. So you can see they are very, very different sort of people.
Okay, who's at number five then?
Right, number five. Coming up, I suppose, a modern-day rider, current rider, if the pandemic ends, Jason Crump. I'd known his dad, Phil, quite well. I did some work with Phil. I used to manage Phil for a couple of years during Phil's heyday, arranging his German continental grass track speedway meeting. So I've known Jason literally since he was a baby, since a baby in nappies, and that I do mean that literally. That signed him then, when he was 16 to ride for us at Exeter. He really was a tremendous rider. You'd have a fallout with Jason during a meeting. You would fall out with him, but you'd guarantee that the following morning he'd be on the phone, he'd say, "Hi boss, it's Jason. Sorry, I shouldn't have said that last night." And all forgotten. Mm-hmm. And you just knew that that was his... One of the things he always said to when he was racing for us, and he said, "Never ever ask me if I want to go in heat 15. Tell me. It's your decision to take, your team manager's decision to take. Just tell me. Say, you're in heat 15.
Well, you can't argue with that, can you?
You can't. No, you can't. Relatively easy to always to do a deal with. There were quite a few riders who you would do a deal with at the beginning of the season, and no matter what happened, they would never, ever come back and say, oh, this, that, the other has happened. I want more money. Mm. Jason was one of those. Like, another one who isn't in my team, but was a super guy to deal with on that basis, Mick Poole. They just accepted, once they'd done the deal, if they smashed up five bikes in a row, that was down to them. Nothing to do with the promoter. They would always get on with it. And there were a lot of riders who were the opposite. Like, I've known riders, not necessarily who've ridden for me, but there was one famous Scandinavian rider who was known as someone who would never, ever stick to his deal. Would always hold the promoter to ransom at some stage in the season, threaten not to ride, threaten to down tools. And when you go back and look at this rider's particular record, you can see why he changed clubs almost every year. Mm-hmm. Because promoters just literally had enough of him. Promoters, by and large, you know, don't renege on their deals with a rider. And I think it's incumbent on riders not to renege on their deals with the promoter. You know, he'd have his little flare-ups and his bursts on an actual meeting, but you know, I think that was just the adrenaline.
That just shows you care as well, I think, as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. And, yeah, you know, Jason's sort of someone else that we sort of still keep in touch with, you know, still talk to each other quite regularly, and you know, managed to keep his, you know, secret touring for about a month that he was coming back to England.
Yes, I know, and we hope that happens in some form or another.
Yeah, he's still, you know, keen to do it. You know, he still wants to do it.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that. We just hope that he gets the opportunity.
Absolutely. Two places left in your team then. Who's next?
Greg Hancock. How can you not include someone who's ridden for so long?
I was going to say, there's an entire generation of people who've not known a world of Speedway, or indeed Speedway Grand Prix, without him being involved.
Well, no, they certainly haven't known Speedway Grand Prix without him being involved, have they? Because, okay, he wasn't involved last year, but that was only through, sadly, the illness that Jenny had. But he was, if you remember, he was actually named in the Grand Prix lineup both last year and this year.
Yeah.
Until he you know, felt he needed to withdraw. Like he's just like a 30-year-old, isn't he? A 29-year-old. You, it's almost unfathomable that at 50 he can still be racing and can still have the enthusiasm for it. I always remember, again, going back to Ivan, that you know, he always said to me, he said, I could carry on racing till I'm 50, but I couldn't carry on with everything else involved. I couldn't carry on with the travel, with the late nights, with all. He said that is the side that stops you riding till you're 50.
Yeah.
But Greg has overcome all that. And, you know, to win world titles so far apart, what was it? He won, 96 was it, his first one?
I think so, yeah.
And his last one, you're nearly, certainly 20 years, nearly more than 20 years apart, wasn't it? That is absolutely unbelievable, isn't it? In any sport, it's unbelievable.
And then to win it then so soon after that as well.
Yeah, to keep winning it and still to be at that level. And like I'm sure that if Greg decided he wants to make a comeback next year, he'd still be at that same level. He's a nice bloke. He's he's very young, isn't he, at heart. He is still on totally the same wavelength as teenagers. And with 20-year-olds, he speaks the same language of them without, you know, looking stupid. Like most of us, if we, you know, say, oh, you're wicked and stuff like that, that, you know, people look at you and say, well, what's this old bloody man doing trying to pretend he's a teenager?
Yeah, he's certainly cooler than me now.
Yeah, he's cooler than us all, isn't he?
It was 97, 2011, 2014 and 2016.
So 97 to 2011. 14
years.
It's a long, long time, isn't it?
I mean, some riders have started their careers and ended it in less time than that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you look how many riders must have retired during Greg's career.
Oh, hundreds.
It's got to be, hasn't it? Literally, it has to be hundreds.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there are riders who, you weren't born. when Greg was racing in a world final.
Well, indeed, yeah. I mean, there's riders riding now who have, well, they were born 2003, 2004.
Yeah.
Must be.
Yeah. He's another one who treats everybody the same, irrespective of their age. He isn't condescending towards young people. He will take young people on board. If he thinks young people can do a job, he will employ them. He's just got no age. He hasn't got an ageism gene in his body. You know, and that's probably why he's been so successful for so long. And he's such a bloody nice bloke. He's, you know, again, I've had more dealings with him probably over the last 2 years, say, than perhaps the whole of his career. By that I mean speaking to him more regularly, you know, because we were sort of involved on talking about something, and I did a lot of early features this year, you know, with him. And he's another one who says, you know, if you WhatsApp him at 3 o'clock our time on next Thursday afternoon, you know that when you call at 3 o'clock next Thursday afternoon, he will answer.
Mm-hmm.
If he doesn't, he will immediately send you a message. Oh, sorry, could you ring me in half an hour? Or we'll ring you back in half an hour. There are an awful lot of people who don't do that. You know, there are lots of people, aren't there, who arrange to talk to, and then they, you know, they're not there for one reason or another. But Greg, he always seems to be there.
It must make it a lot easier for you being a journalist when you're trying to track these people down as well, because I guess, you know, to know that you've got someone like Greg that you can pick up the phone to and arrange to talk to, and you know it's not going to be a hassle, must make your job a lot easier as well.
Absolutely, yeah, because the big thing about being sort of a journalist, particularly working for national newspapers, is that you, by and large, the big names mean something to the sports editors and the sports staff. Like, I can almost guarantee I will get a story in a national newspaper about Ty Buffenden, simply because they know, they've heard of Ty Buffenden. And equally, yeah, the way they've heard of, you know, of Greg Hancock.
Mm-hmm.
And then this year, the pandemic has been strange, because it's been the easiest time there has ever been to actually speak to riders.
Yes.
Because, you know, they're not on aeroplanes. You know, they're in, at the moment, they're all in Poland on lockdown. So by and large, you can get them. You know, if you ring them, they will answer, because they're in the one place. They're not deciding they've got to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to get a flight from Wrocław back to Stansted, and then tomorrow they're back off to Sweden. You know, so it's been a real buzz for journalists, yeah. And I would imagine it applies to any other sport except football. Like football, obviously, you never ever speak to a footballer these days as a journalist. But yes. Speedway, you always do.
So you've got one slot left, one world champion left.
Yeah, I've got one world champion left. And again, there is a story behind this. It's Peter Craven. I saw him quite regularly at Bellevue during the early 60s until his death. So it's not that I didn't see him. I certainly didn't see him at Liverpool, because, you know, they got rid of him when he was still in his teens. Obviously, Frank McLean, who I've spoken about, he told me all sorts of things about him. He was spectacular, crowd pleaser, lovely guy. Again, friendly, great with the fans. You just wonder what he might have achieved if he hadn't been killed in 63, because he was then, he was a two-time world champion. He just lost his world title, hadn't he, in 60, when he had that accident at Edinburgh, the old Meadowbank. So I have to include him, because he is the link to all my Speedway.
Yeah, absolutely. You
know, without sort of Peter Craven, I don't know, would I have got involved in Speedway? I don't really know.
And what I'm finding is that I think for everybody who I've spoken to on this, their involvement in Speedway has very much been in that way, that, you know, there's been a chance meeting with it in many respects. And, you know, the love affair from then goes on. But I guess that's life, isn't it?
That's certainly Speedway life, Ian, isn't it? That, you know, you do either fall in love with the sport, or you just don't you hate the sport. You think it's absolutely boring and not worth going and watching. Yeah, I'm glad to say I don't think my love for the sport has ever dimmed. I'm not one of those who believes it was better in the old days. It wasn't. The racing today, is as good as it's ever been. On occasions, it's as bad as it's ever been. A really good speedway meeting is still something that I don't think you can get a better sporting experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, with your sporting experience putting together here then, so that's your team, your all-time 1-7, Ivan Major, Ty Woofenden, Barry Briggs, Ovi Funden, Jason Crump, Greg Hancock, Peter Craven. Who's going to referee this?
Now, this might come as a surprise to you.
Mm-hmm.
It'll certainly come to a surprise as a lot of the riders. I know that most people so far have said Tony Steele.
Yeah.
And I certainly wouldn't argue with Tony Steele. But strangely enough, I would go for Frank Ebden. Frank had a reputation of being a real stickler, a rule book man. And that is actually what I really loved about Frank Ebden. You knew what he was going to do. If he told you to sit still at the start as a rider, that if they didn't sit still at the start, he would exclude them.
Mm-hmm.
He would fine them. He was an absolute stick. He would go by the rule book all the time. But you knew that he would. He wouldn't bend the rules. He wouldn't favour someone because, like referees sometimes do. Oh, well, yeah. He was just a straight up and down sort of bloke. I don't know. Sometimes I'd prefer someone you know exactly what he's going to do. Because you can never then go back and say, oh, you didn't say that.
At least you're dealing with the rule book then. If it's in the rule book, you know what he's going to do.
He didn't make up the rules.
Yeah.
He just followed the rules. He did exactly what it said in the rule book. And he did exactly what he said to you. I think I was probably one of the few team managers. I don't think you'll get anyone else saying Frank Ebden as the referee. He would run the meeting quickly. You knew that the two-minute buzzer would go on almost as soon as the race was over. He wouldn't sort of tolerate you saying, oh, I want another 5 minutes. Can we all have a cup of coffee? He was just so totally straight up and down. And I like people who are straight up and down because you can't complain if they stick to it.
you know what you're getting.
Yeah, he would never tell you something to your face and then go against it or not follow it through.
Mm-hmm.
He was smart, he was intelligent. Despite what people think, I think he genuinely had a love of Speedway. A lot of people said, oh, he only goes there, gets to the track and wants to get home as quickly as possible. I don't believe that. I think Frank was a genuine Speedway fan. I think he was a sad loss when he stopped refereeing because on occasions there are too many referees who just make up their decisions on the hoof. They haven't really thought them through, but Frank knew exactly what he was going to do. And you couldn't pull the wool over his eyes. It was never worth going on to Frank and trying to argue that he'd got the decision wrong because you knew he would never, ever change his decision. He made the decision that he thought was right. Every referee, every team manager, every rider gets decisions on crashes wrong. You get different views, don't you? But you knew that Frank would make it for the simple reason he thought it was right.
And on the subject of the rule book, if you were to be permitted to change one rule, or maybe slightly more, depending, where would you start on that?
The first one I would do, which I've thought quite long and hard about it, is go back to the time when riders could touch the tapes and were only excluded if they actually broke them.
Mm.
And I would also, almost coupled with that, I would do away with all the rules that have, over the years, almost made team managers obsolete and redundant. I would just like to see a total free-for-all. You have your seven riders, and you put them wherever you want in the team, so that your team managers then would have to use their skills and their knowledge. Yeah, and the same with sort of things like tactical substitutes. Not none of this. Oh, you can use a tactical substitute, but only in heats A to F.
Yeah.
And then in X to Y, not in G because he is in it. Straight open. If you wanted to put Ty Woffenden at reserve, do it. And then it's up to the opposing team manager to combat that.
And it's kind of like what they do in Poland in a way, isn't it? They do have more flexibility to move the positions around a little bit more there.
Yeah, why not? Why not be able to have a rider who is good at, same with gate positions. I'd do away with fixed gate positions. I know a lot of people will argue vehemently against that and say, well, no, this helps. But why shouldn't you be able to pick between your riders what gate position they go off?
Mm.
So if you've got a really good gaiter who's good off the inside, let him go off the inside every race if you think that's the advantage of your team.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I believe that team managers should be as, I'm not going to say as important as, because that should never be the case, that riders are always going to be the most important people. But team managers should have more say on the results of meetings. Team managers, so if they get it wrong and they're not very good, the team will lose. If they get it right, then there's a possibility the team will win. Whereas today, your team managers are almost redundant, aren't they? What do? Very little.
Yeah, just implement what little control they have, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. And their only argument is, oh, well, the rule book says A, B, C, and D. You know, just like, let's have a bloody free-for-all. It's like, could you imagine that? I don't know if there is any other sport where there is such a restriction. Like, you don't turn around at football and, you know, to Jurgen Klopp and say, oh, well, you've got to play Jordan Henderson in midfield. If he wants to play him in goal, he can.
Mm-hmm.
You don't turn around in cricket and say that Joe Root has got to bat at number 3. If he wants to open the innings or wants to bat at number 8, he can.
It's a very good point. It's a very good point. And the last question that I have for you is, who would be the opposition for your team of world champion all-stars? So this can be any team, assembled team from history. Well, who would you like to see at this dream meeting of yours?
Yeah. Well, other than going for a Liverpool team from 1940 or something, I would have to probably the. There's a choice, isn't there, between the best team ever, whether it was the Peter Adams Cradley Heath team or the Oxford team of, what was it, 1986?
Mm.
The Oxford team that were unbeaten. I would think I would have to go for the Oxford team because they did go through the season unbeaten. Okay, they didn't run two home matches, but there's absolutely no reason to think they wouldn't have won those final two home matches if the weather hadn't intervened. They were also joint holders, weren't they, of the Knockout Cup. So I think that one, led by Hans Nielsen, would have to be the best. They had, you know, Hansen, Simon Wigg. You know, it wasn't probably man for man the best team that we've ever seen. Certainly the Cradley one would have to have been. But I think that Oxford team, under the rules, was probably the best team we have seen, you know, because you can't argue against a team going unbeaten.
Absolutely not.
And a team wins every league match that they race. How can you argue? That's got to be the best league team there has ever been, hasn't it? Like obviously, yeah, you know, it'd be easy. I could have picked another 7 riders and say, well, that would be the team to race against. You know, you could use a Tony Rickardson and R.C. Ward. But, you know, if we're going for an actual team that there was, I'd go for that Oxford team.
Oxford 1986, then. That's the first time that's been suggested. I think Cradley has been mentioned in the past. But, yeah, I think it's the first mention for Oxford. And you're right, it's such a great team, obviously going unbeaten. But, you know, people like Hans Nielsen and Simon Wigg in that side, it's very strong.
To go unbeaten is amazing, isn't it, in a season.
It's been fantastic speaking with you, Peter. Thanks for spending the time.
It.
And it's been wonderful to hear all those stories. And hopefully we can all get back to a track and watch some new events in the future, hopefully not too long away from now.
Good to talk to you, and do stay safe.
Thanks for listening. Keep checking back to Humans of Speedway's podcast feed, because we've got new episodes on the way. We're going to serialise some more Speedway Paradise moments as well. And of course, for the latest updates and preview clips, you can hear them by subscribing to us on social media. On Facebook, search for Humans of Speedway. And on Twitter, we are at Speedway Humans. And thanks for listening, and speak again soon.